Jay Bhattacharya is a professor of medicine at Stanford University. He's a physician, epidemiologist, health economist, and public health policy expert focusing on infectious diseases and vulnerable population. He's also a co-author and signatory of the Great Barrington Declaration with Professor Martin Koldorf and Sunetra Gupta. I hope I didn't keep you waiting, Jay. Are you with us?
I am. No worries at all. It's interesting to hear the last conversation.
You've probably heard of Lee Dundas before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I have.
Okay.
I've never met her, though.
Yeah, me neither. This is the first time. She was introduced through a friend, through a mutual friend. So how have you been at Stanford, and how has your life been?
It's been an interesting 20 months, let's just say that.
I believe
that. The environment at Stanford, it's interesting. It's like if you look at it from the outside, there are several people who have essentially argued against many of the restrictions and things that we've seen. You know, you see Johnny Eades, you see Mike Leavitt, and a few others. But I have to say, I've been at Stanford for 35 years, and I've never seen an environment so close to open discussion and debate. I mean, I think there's been real threats to academic freedom at Stanford, which I mean, greatly regret.
That is what we're hearing from some of the scientists in this country, and I know that a lot more scientists believe that that is the case. A real scientific debate has been stifled for the past 18 months or so. A good friend, I'm not going to name her name right now, but she's a very well-known professor at one of our universities, told me just last night that she was ready to be working as an expert on a couple of the trials that will be filed also in the United States, but that she is, and she's going to continue to support us behind the line, but she says, I can't come out right now because I'm losing everything. I'm losing my livelihood. So as far as free speech is concerned, we're in pretty bad shape right now.
Yeah, I mean, I have worked as an expert pro bono for, I think, 40 cases, somewhere a very large number of cases. I have to say it's been a frustrating experience, but it's been striking to me. I know there are many, 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 many people, experts, scientific experts, who agree that the lockdowns were a catastrophic mistake, an unscientific catastrophic mistake. You know, tens of thousands of scientists signed the Great Barrington Declaration. And I get emails from them. Many of them have lost, several have lost their jobs. They've lost opportunities to get grants. They've lost colleagues. It's an environment I have never seen before. Normally in science, it's good to disagree with each other. We learn from that disagreement. We don't cancel each other over the disagreement. We don't attack the underlying substrate that allows us to converse, you know, with one another. And what's happened during this pandemic is essentially a freezing out. So I'm not even sure there's a consensus in favor of lockdowns, scientific consensus. I think what's happened is a relatively small group of scientists have grabbed this discourse and frozen the rest of other scientists into thinking that they're alone when they're not.
That is what we think, too. After having interviewed about 150 experts from all walks of science from all over the world, we have come to the conclusion that this has really never been about health. We're not denying that there's a virus out there. It's just that, just like John Ioannidis, who you just mentioned, I think he came to this conclusion through one of his studies, which is in line with what the WHO arrived at. The infection fatality rate of whatever this virus is, there's a lot of people right now, they're saying that this is a man-made virus. Well, doesn't make a difference because the human immune system seems to be able to deal with it. But the infection fatality rate, if it is at 0.14, 0.15%, then that's roughly about the same as the common flu. So it doesn't we can't really understand, the people who are trying to dig into this can't really understand, what is this about? It's definitely not about health.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that. So that I use the number 0.2. I mean, you know, it's 0.2%, somewhere in that range from the seroprevalence studies. The key thing, though, to me is not the median infection fatality rate. The key thing is the sharp gradient in the age for the risk. So people who are older actually do face a very substantial risk of infection fatality rate from this. Even from, this is from John's studies. You know, 5, 7, 8%, somewhere. I mean, it's a very high infection fatality rate if you're over the age of let's say 70 or 80. On the other hand, children face a very vanishingly low infection fatality rate risk. That is the centrally most important fact about the policy response. Mm-hmm. Even if the infection fatality rate is higher as a mean, the key thing is that age grading. I think nobody denies that. And so if that's true, the right policy response is to have a focused protection. Find the people that are actually at risk, move heaven and earth to protect them, and then disrupt the rest of society as little as possible, because the disruption of society harms everybody, even the vulnerable. And I think this is the pandemic strategy we follow for a century. You know, in basically every pandemic before this one, for a century, we followed it very successfully, actually. Mm-hmm. Pandemics are going to produce, you know, misery and death. It's unfortunately not avoidable. That's what diseases like this do. The question only for policy is, how do you minimize that harm, both from the virus itself and also from the response? And I think that's the debate that we should have had all last year, that was suppressed. Mm-hmm. Right? Instead of allowing that debate to happen, what happened was a panicked response with saying that we should follow the precautionary principle, and then with that panic, there came this like impetus to suppress any opposition whatsoever. If you oppose the lockdown while you're in favor of the virus. I mean, that's insane. That weird, insane thing, I think, froze many, many scientists from speaking up when they otherwise would have.
But when you refer to these, higher death rates in the old aged group, but that's also taking into account that a lot of them have pre-existing conditions.
And their immune systems are probably, in many cases, weakened compared with the rest of the population.
So that's another thing that it's not only about like older people, but people maybe in special risk constellations from the beginning. So like maybe in, you know, especially intense care, old age homes or something like that. So where the risk then becomes more obvious or more prevalent.
May I just add one thing? When the median age of those people dying with COVID-19, the old age people, is 84 in Germany or something like that, this is the time the people die. They start dying. Many people die in this age between 84 and 94 or 95. Around this, most of the people die, and they all die with something. And we cannot change this. And if we find COVID-19, we find it in perhaps not even 10% of them. But there are 200 other viruses that would be there and help those people dying. And what are we talking about? I think we have to have in mind that this is not a catastrophe that people die very old.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of conversation is fine. I mean, I think the question of where we prioritize our resources and how much is a good conversation to have. And I agree that older people, I mean, it's never in medicine, it's never the pathogen itself. It's the interaction between the pathogen and the person infected that produces the result, right? So, if someone with underlying conditions, of course, is going to be more vulnerable. And it is a good question. How much do we put resources toward protection of people that are at high risk? I personally, I'm okay with putting resources toward protecting vulnerable people, even if, you know, because I don't want to expose people that we can protect, even if they're only going to live for a short while longer, that, you know, maybe quite valuable to them. But that's a social conversation about where we put our resources. the problem I've had with the response all along is that instead of acknowledging this absolutely clear biological fact of this age gradient and risk, including the as you say, the risk posed by underlying health conditions, and then saying, look, we should acknowledge this and then design our response around it. Instead, what we decided is the only way to protect the vulnerable was to close society down. And that's failed. That has utterly failed. We have, you know, 5 million deaths worldwide, a huge number of older, 80% of the deaths are over the age of 65, I think, something like that. 40% of the deaths, in at least in the United States, are at care homes. Some people thought that protecting the lockdowns would protect the vulnerable, but that clearly was an error. We do not actually have a technology to stop the spread of this virus. We do not actually have a technology to stop the spread of the virus. What the lockdown did, if they protected anybody, was a small group of maybe 30% of the population who could afford to not lose their jobs when they're working from home. And the rest of society, whether you're vulnerable or not, was told, go get exposed. You keep society running. It was I call it trickle-down epidemiology. Uh-huh. It's a kind of like classist approach to infectious disease control, and what we learned is that you can't only protect the rich and then expect to have a good result for everybody.
This is a kind of if I understand you correctly, this one size fits all approach destroys much more than it does good for the people who should really get special protection.
It does. And I think this is one of these things where, so what is the precautionary principle? This was the argument people made at the beginning of the pandemic. We don't know how deadly the disease is. Let's assume the worst about it. And that allows us to have some guide for how much we should respond to it. Okay, that's reasonable. I mean, I don't know exactly what the disease is going to do. I want to calibrate my response to it. But when you apply that principle, you can't then turn around and assume that the interventions you're going to engage in are also low cost or low harm. You have to have a clear-eyed assessment of the harms from the interventions themselves. In retrospect, we should have known this, but it's come out to be absolutely true. The lockdowns have produced devastating harm to the health of populations worldwide, especially the poor. In developed countries, there are enormous backlogs of people who skipped their cancer screening. And women are showing up with later stage breast cancer than they would have if we caught it last year. Men and women are showing up with later stage colon cancer. The psychological harm is absolutely catastrophic. You know, in June of last year in the United States, the CDC ran a study that found 1 in 4 young adults between ages 18 and 24 seriously considered suicide.
Wow.
1 in 4. Now, the suicide rates haven't changed, but at least that's the reported suicide rates have not gone. But on the other hand, there's been this catastrophic increase in drug abuse and deaths from fentanyl and opioids, what we call the deaths of despair during the last recession. I think it's just the tip of the iceberg. These are not harms that go away immediately. They're going to take concerted effort to address. In the UK, there's an enormous backlog of elective surgeries, which include, including heart operations, in fact. Now that's the developed world. I think the health consequences are going to be, have been and will continue to be catastrophic for quite a while of these lockdowns. In the developing world, though, it's orders of magnitude worse. Right, so we have a globalized system of economics that essentially over the last 30, 40 years, whatever you want to say about it, it lifted a billion people out of poverty, right? And the way it did that is because poor countries reorganized their economies, the local economies, in order to fit in with the global commerce, and it worked in some sense. I mean, it produced all kinds of inequality and there's all kinds of problems, but at the same time, it did lift a billion people out of poverty. Overnight with the lockdowns, we said those promises that we made to developing countries, we just broke because of the lockdowns. And predictably, 100 million people have been thrown into dire poverty, less than $3 a day of income worldwide in poor countries. 100 million, 80 million people, according to the UN, have been thrown into dire food insecurity, essentially hunger. Hundreds of thousands of children in South Asia are dead from hunger as a consequence of the lockdowns and the economic dislocation of them. We, in the early days of the epidemic, said, well, we shouldn't trade economics for health. But that was immoral, because the economics for the poor around the world is health, is life. And so I think it's one of these things where, like, the whole discourse has been dominated by a very narrow group of people, virologists, epidemiologists, who do not actually have the expertise to reorder society the way they think they do. And they're did not actually protect society from, because there's much more to human health than just one virus. And to pretend like that's the case for 2 years has been and will continue to be a catastrophic disaster.
Do you know what's always struck me in this whole process is, you know, if you decide for this kind of direction, and you do everything, you know, in order to get a valuable picture of, like, the possible collateral damage, you know, you really examine it, like, everything very closely. Like, for instance, like, when the new virus hits, you do a lot of autopsies in order to get, like, a picture what's really going on. But that has not happened, you know, here with us, and we've seen that in a lot of countries. Like, autopsies were, I mean, either forbidden or at least strictly kind of discouraged. People were discouraged from doing that. And so I think that's a strange approach. You know, if everything would have been done in order to get, like, a proper scientific idea of what's going on, maybe also from that, you know, better conclusions would have been, you know, able to draw, so that we can then also take care of the risks, the population, the part of the population that's more at risk, like, even properly, more properly. So I think it seems to be very lopsided. I mean, this kind of approach, you know, to go for that one fits all, what Rainer said, like, one fits all idea, but then not looking at the whole picture, like, both from the virus side and from what's going to go on with the, what's going to come from the, like, on the collateral side. So I think that makes me very uneasy, you know, to see this kind of disparity. Why do you think that was? I mean, what was the reason that so many scientists, or this crowd, like a group of scientists, really hopped onto this only virus, and we have to approach it in that, you know,
lockdown approach?
Why is that? Why
was that an accident? Or we're getting the feeling from, having listened to all these experts, we're getting the feeling that this is an agenda that's being rolled out.
I mean, I guess that's not my expertise to comment on whether it's agenda, but I'll say in the literature on this that I've seen, there's a really fascinating article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on this issue of, like, why were all Western governments, or actually even governments worldwide, why did they adopt this extraordinary approach when the pre-pandemic plans didn't call for it. So the basic idea was policy copying, right? So people saw China, and it looked like China's lockdowns worked to stop the disease from spreading in January, February of 2020. And then they looked at Italy, and it was a catastrophic disaster there. You know, bodies in the piled up in cathedrals, I mean, the hospitals overrun, an absolute catastrophic disaster. And they all thought, well, China's approach worked and Italy's didn't. Mm. And for politicians, this is a virus spreading. This is a disease. Who do you turn to? Well, you turn to people who have expertise in viruses, who have expertise in diseases spreading, you know, epidemiologists and virologists. And they are, I have to say, very narrowly trained.
Yeah.
And for a politician, what do they think? They are in a position where they're going to get judged if bad things happen. They need to have some reason, some excuse, something to say, well, look, I follow the science. most of them don't have the expertise to decide one way or the other. And so they have this group of experts telling them, well, the lockdown worked here and what didn't work there, we should lock down. And how do you push back? It's very difficult for any politician to push back in that setting, because if they do push back and there's a catastrophic failure, well, their career is over. Mm-hmm. If they don't push back, well, they have an excuse. The experts told, I did what the experts did. And okay, yeah, bad things happened, but I did what the experts told me to do. I mean, that's, for instance, what Andrew Cuomo did in New York.
But what is kind of strange is that also kind of early on, you know, other people came out, like also Wolfgang Wodak, and said, well, this is not the right way to go. And it's very strange that this conversation that could have started there, the scientific conversation, you know, that was absolutely turned down, like even with really nasty words, you know, that these people were crazy or like were like whatever, like
conspiracy theorists,
or just didn't have the had no scientific clue or were too old or whatever. You know, that's very strange, because I mean, I can understand that in the beginning, you know, maybe you'd run in that direction and go for the seemingly safe approach, but then later on a
closer analysis has to happen.
Could have happened also, because there were people saying, well, it's going in the, like, also if you think of John Ioannidis saying, well, this is maybe not the right way to do, or doing some meta study and saying it's not so dangerous, let's look at it more closely, but that never happened. So it's kind of strange that they were stuck in that direction.
No, it was an absolutely devastatingly nasty environment for scientists. I saw Wolfgang was canceled. I mean, and John of course was also faced this. I personally also faced this. I mean, instead of having a debate, I was the senior author on the Santa Clara seroprevalence study and the LA County seroprevalence study. Mm-hmm. The attacks on it were in the press instead of like a discussion about what the implications were. Like when in April of 2020, we found that 2.8% of Santa Clara County in California had the disease. People had antibodies. In LA County, we found 4%. That should have led to a conversation about, well, this disease is already so far along that it's not possible to get down to zero.
When was that? Was that in March of 2020 or was it in April?
April 2020. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And John, of course, John Ioannidis wrote this article in Stat News in March of 2020 saying, well, we don't know how widespread it is. We need to have a study to do that, so that we can decide what the right response is. Prominent scientists like Wolfgang, like John, essentially were shouted down and marginalized as if they were nobody, as if they didn't actually have expertise. And part of the issue is that by April of 2020, catastrophic mistakes had already been made. Mm-hmm. And once you follow down this line, and you're Anthony Fauci, you've provided this advice that we need to lock the whole world down. Well, you know, you've already caused an incredible amount of damage. You don't see the catastrophic harms, the collateral damage that we were just talking about, because you're such a narrow-minded scientist, and you just dig in. And of course, you have to marginalize all the other people all the prominent people that would disagree with you, because otherwise you can't get your way. And someone might conclude that you've done something terribly wrong, or you made a catastrophic mistake. I mean, I think that is ultimately going to be the judgment of history on Anthony Fauci's tenure there. Is that like this decision to lock down the world, lock down the United States was a catastrophic error. Yeah. By the way, there's a charity in the UK that I'm working with closely called Collateral Global. Collateral Global. And we've commissioned a number of studies to measure some of these lockdown harms that we've talked about. Carl Hennigan's working with us, Sunetra Gupta. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you can hide these things. There's such catastrophic events that have harmed so many people. It's not possible to hide those consequences, the kinds of consequences I'm talking about. What the debate will be is, well, it would have happened anyways, lockdown or no lockdown, but that is nonsense, right? The catastrophic harms from, I'll just give you one example. In California, for almost 18 months, public school kids were more or less locked out of school. My kids were unable to go to school, like unable to go physically in school. In Sweden, every school is open the full time, 100%, no restrictions. I would never have voluntarily left my kids, kept my kids out of school. Never. It was a crazy, useless tactic brought out of panic, because kids are not super spreaders. They're not the ones who are spreading this disease. Amazingly, we knew that from early on. We knew that in April of 2020 from this fantastic Icelandic study. The children were actually very inefficient spreaders. On this basis of this, many parts of Europe kept their schools open, but not California. Those were not voluntary decisions. Those were decisions made by government to force people to alter what they did. The other thing that they did is they panicked the population.
Yes.
That is an absolute enormous violation of the public trust. Creating panic creates bad decisions, and the only reason for it was to essentially so that the policymakers could get their way. Mm-hmm. There has to be a counter reaction. I think we're starting to see a counter reaction. By the way, I don't think. Even early on, governors like Governor DeSantis in Florida, a few other governors in the United States pushed back, and now we're seeing that the people who've been really harmed by this, of starting to vote out the people that caused it, right? Virginia, the Democratic candidate, he wasn't the governor, but he was a very strong proponent of school closures and lockdowns, got voted out.
What you can also see, I think it's not only the lockdown harm, but now since we have this vaccination problem, with maybe harm as well, or like harm that's becoming, the side effects since it's not tested so much. And I mean, like also, if you see now these ideas of like mandatory vaccination, where you cannot even, decide freely if you want it, take part in that experiment or not. So I think that's another thing. So it's like, even not only it was over the top to go for the lockdown, but it seems that more and more and more problematic decisions then have been taken in order to follow maybe that narrative that was where they took the wrong turn and overreacted, and then it's maybe that seems to be the exit, but then not even that is the exit road to normality. So we don't even know what further they might have up their sleeve in order to continue with this like wrong narrative, instead of starting like a public discussion about it, or like a scientific public discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the vaccines are interesting. So like, let's go back to like March of 2020, right? So I have studied vaccines and I've worked on vaccine safety with the FDA for a while. My impression with vaccines was, and it, I think is true, is that it takes quite a while, long time to develop, test, and then deploy a vaccine. So I saw President Trump's decision to do this Operation Warp Speed investment, where the idea was that we could get a vaccine very quickly. And I thought, well, it's unlikely to succeed in March. I mean, obviously I was wrong at that. But it seemed to me at the time an extraordinary bet. Mm-hmm. But it's I think a bet that prolonged the lockdown. Well, we have a vaccine. It's producing. It's we have a. It looks like it's coming along. If we just lock down until the vaccine comes, we can solve the epidemic. I think that thought actually promoted the lockdowns, because if we have an endpoint, well, we can bear almost anything, even this horrible lockdown. The vaccines arrived. And I actually was quite happy to see them. I mean, I still actually am quite happy to see them. I think for people who face a very high risk of disease, of death from COVID or severe disease from COVID, it's actually quite good. I mean, I think for older people, if you're mitigating a high risk, you're willing to put up with a little more uncertainty on the other side, right? So in medicine, it's always the case that medicine has side effects, and you balance the benefits against the side effects. Right, that's the whole practice of medicine. There's no intervention that's completely benign. So you're always balancing. Some of them are much more benign than others, right? Mm-hmm. And so, to me, using the vaccines to mitigate the risk of severe disease from COVID was a really good thing especially for older people. They may die of one of the other 200 things that Wolfgang mentioned, but at the same time, you protected against COVID. That's not a bad thing. As you get closer and closer to younger people who face a low risk, well, then the balance of risk and benefit gets much closer. Mm-hmm. So, you are willing to put up with less side effects and uncertainty when you're mitigating a very small risk, like for instance, for children. So to me, I thought about the vaccine as sort of an individual clinical choice, right? You have to decide for yourself, is this worth the risk? And you have that kind of conversations with your doctor all the time, I would think, right? Where you're deciding, here's a drug or therapy or vaccine or whatever, and you have to, will it help me? I think a lot of the people who were pushing the vaccines thought of it as a public benefit, right? Because that's true for many vaccines. If I get my children vaccinated with a DPT vaccine, they're not going to get the disease. They're not going to spread it to others. It's a much more effective vaccine that way. I think many people thought that this vaccine would be like that also.
But it's not.
It is not. This vaccine, after several months, no longer protects you against, or has very minimal protection against, getting infected. I still think it protects you against severe disease mm-hmm. at five, six, seven months. But at 5, 6, 7 months, it no longer protects you against getting infected. So for instance, I got the vaccination in April of 2021, and I got COVID in August of 2021.
But I have a question. Do you know any other vaccine that has the number necessary to treat, to vaccine, which is about around 100, like those vaccines we now are getting, they try to get to use with us? Do you know any other vaccines with such a high number necessary to vaccine to avoid one case?
It's a question of like what the context the vaccines are used, right? So, for instance, diphtheria is very rare in the U.S. And so you're vaccinating large numbers of kids with diphtheria against diphtheria, and you're not really preventing very many cases just simply because the vaccine is so effective. So it's a complicated number. If you're in an environment where diphtheria is very, very common, high prevalence, then you vaccinate, that number will be much lower. The other thing about this vaccine, again, I think of it as like an individual thing, right? So it's the risk mitigation for old people is you're in principle getting a much better you're mitigating against a high risk. Yes. And so I'm willing to put up with, I can give the vaccine to very few old people. I'm going to save a lot more, lives than if I give it to lots of young people.
When you want to travel with your children to a dangerous country where diphtheria is still endemic, it's good to have this vaccination.
Exactly.
You're saying this is an individual choice because the most important aspect about these vaccines, and this is what I used to think is what makes a vaccine, it provides immunity. It doesn't. It doesn't. They claim that it protects you from severe adverse, or rather from severe cases of COVID. We're not even sure if that's true, because the numbers that we're seeing from Israel and the UK is that between 85 and 86% of the people who are hospitalized with COVID symptoms have been twice vaccinated. So we'll have to take a much closer look at how these vaccines really work. Yes. Even the inventor of the mRNA vaccination technique, Robert Malone, we had him on our committee, and he's a very soft-spoken man. But in the meantime, he has, I guess you could say, he has become outraged. He says this is a violation of all medical ethical principles. We shouldn't have gone that far. Not with these mRNA vaccines.
I guess I'm more convinced about the long-term, about the protection against severe disease. I mean, they're like these cohort studies. Because you can't look at just how many people are hospitalized that have the vaccine. You have to look at the population at large how many got the vaccine were at risk of being hospitalized, and then give the fraction of people that get hospitalized as a fraction of the people that get the vaccine in the population. So studies like that tend to find some longer lasting protection against hospitalization risk and death. I'm fairly convinced by that. But those same studies are the ones that are finding no protection against infection, or very little protection against infection after a few months.
I think it's very impossible and very, very necessary in Israel, for instance, to distinguish whether damage comes from those people in hospitals, whether it comes from the spikes protein given by the vaccine, or whether it comes from spike protein from a natural virus. I don't know whether there is somebody who has distinguished this.
I mean, there's the antibody test. There's a make a distinction with the antibody test when it's there. So like if you're infected with the virus, you produce antibodies to the nucleocapsid.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're and also the spike protein, but if you're infected if you have the vaccine, then you only produce antibodies to the spike protein.
That's a good thing. Do you know any work who did anybody do this distinguish?
There's some small studies I've seen this, but I haven't seen it at scale. I think it would be very, very interesting.
This would be very important, I think. For Israel, it would be, I think, the most important study to do.
And these antibody tests are cheap. I actually don't know why we haven't been using, like I did these seropovin studies. I thought that we would be using them at scale all the time to track the progress of the disease.
Yeah.
But we really haven't, and it's kind of puzzling to me. I mean, I have some theories, but I think it's important to understand what the use of the vaccines then could be. If I'm right, then the use of the vaccine is a personal protection against severe disease.
Yes.
With a decision made in consultation with a doctor about your own personal health. It's not a tool for mass eradication of the disease. This disease cannot be eradicated. It's dogs get infected with it. Cats get infected with it. There was a study by the USDA a few months ago that 40% of white-tailed deer in the United States, deer, you know, the animal, have antibodies to the vaccine, not to the COVID, the US. You know, bats apparently, I guess, getting infected with this. So this is not an eradicable disease. It meets none of the criteria for an eradicable disease. And the vaccine, ironically, where, you know, the World Health Organization changed its definition of herd immunity in response to the Great Barrington Declaration, saying it's just vaccine-mediated herd immunity. Ironically, if this vaccine doesn't stop the spread of the disease, then it actually doesn't contribute all that much to herd immunity.
That's true.
Exactly. Isn't it? It always puzzled me when I heard, this is the second time they changed the definition of a very important in terms of pandemics, of a very important aspect. The first time they changed the definition of something was in 2009, when they decided to newly define what a pandemic is. Before that, it was three elements that were needed, that were necessary to have a pandemic. One is a worldwide, a disease that spreads worldwide with many serious cases of illnesses, and three, many deaths. Then they changed it to a disease that spreads worldwide, which ultimately made it possible to make any common flu into a pandemic. And then they changed, and that's what started the swine flu. And then they changed the definition of overnight the definition of what herd immunity is. It's as if they are trying, in this particular context of the corona crisis, as if they're trying to make people believe that the only way out and the only way to achieve herd immunity is by getting the shots. And not just getting 70% of the people to get the shots, but getting 100% of the people. And that doesn't really... I used to do a lot of medical law, but I'm not a medical doctor. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
Yeah, you don't need 100% of people vaccinated in order for this for this disease to end. I mean, the disease will be endemic. It's not possible for it to go away.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's not that scary, right? I think the reinfections that tend to be much milder than the initial infection. The immune system working, right? The immune memory produces some protection even if you can get reinfected. The reinfection rates seem to be quite low. If you're infected 1 year after infection, the reinfection rates in several studies are somewhere between 0.3 and 0.8%. I mean, it's a very, very low rate of reinfection. And again, the reinfection tends to be milder. This will become like a circulating coronavirus, the four other circulating coronaviruses. It'll become everyone on Earth will be repeatedly exposed to this over their lifetime, several times.
And the WHO, they kept that it should be a new virus. And they said it's very important that we protect the people against new viruses. And they just ignored that the virus is new every year. And each year, they just it's a natural thing. And we are very much used to new viruses, which is no problem for our immune system. We have, because the viruses have so many epitopes we recognize, and we are fit to find out that's almost the same as last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. It's like Sunetra Gupta, she has this idea of this sort of virome, the global virome, and one idea is that by repeated exposures to different pathogens over a long period of time, and you're training your immune system, you actually become healthier, right? And globalization actually has helped produce this. Like that's one potential reason why life expectancy has gone up.
It's a very, very interesting hypothesis, because when you make a lockdown and when you isolate people in home for elderly people, for instance, they have no contact with their family anymore. They lose their training.
Yeah.
Perhaps you don't even protect them if you do this.
I know. I mean, I think we might actually. Well, if she's right, then we'll have an immune deficit that we'll pay consequences for over time in terms of worse health. And we'll see. Can I go back to the lockdowns? Because it just occurred to me, like, one thought that I've had about the lockdowns, about why we had them, and why didn't we do that, for instance, in 2009. You know, I think Zoom is partly responsible for the lockdowns. I mean, if you don't, because now 30% of people, the rich 30%, won't lose their jobs if you have a lockdown. But that wasn't true in 2009.
Did you, when you mentioned the study that you and John Ioannidis and others conducted in March or April of 2020, I heard about it on the news on the mainstream news even, because my wife and I were still in California at that time. And I began to wonder if, I don't know if I wrote the figures down correctly, was it, how many people did you find that had antibodies already in Santa Clara County? Was it 2.8% or more?
Yeah, so it's a little, so the study itself was, we sampled about 3,000 people. Mm-hmm. There were 50 positives. Mm-hmm. We had a sampling scheme that oversampled the richer parts of mm-hmm. Santa Clara County. So once you do the adjustment, and poorer parts of Santa Clara County tend to be higher infection rates. Mm-hmm. Once you do the adjustment for that, that's how you get 2.8%. We ran a very similar study in LA County, mm-hmm. almost exactly the same time, with a very different sampling scheme, where we had a representative sample, and there we got 4% mm-hmm. antibodies. Mm-hmm. Both imply about an infection fatality rate of about 0.2%. Mm-hmm. Now, these were community-dwelling populations. We didn't sample people in nursing homes. So 0.2% in community-dwelling populations.
I mean, one remark with the, with the lockdowns or like extra caretaking measures for the risk group, I think, I mean, to my understanding of like freedom or like freedom of choice, you know, I think it would also have been important to let these people choose whether they want to take the risk of maybe, you know, without maybe infecting others, but maybe seeing their relatives, you know, deciding I want to take the risk because maybe my lifetime is very limited, you know, maybe I only have like 3 months ahead or something, like what doctors say. then it's very, you know, it was also very brutal what we saw here and in other places of the world, America as well, that these people were really locked in their old people's homes and died without seeing their kids anymore, you know, before they died. I mean, that's also something that's, I mean, both terrible for the ones deceased, but also what's that going to do or has done to your psychological well-being, you know, as a relative that you were not able to say goodbye. I think that's something that we're going to carry with us as a society for a very long time.
No, what we did was cruel to older people.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I forget the number, but like an enormous increase in deaths among dementia patients. Those are deaths by loneliness.
Yes.
In nursing home settings. I mean, I think it has to always be individual. Like you have to say, okay, I'm going to lock you away just because you're old and high risk, and not pay attention to what you value is an error. So I'm a big proponent of focus protection, which to me means providing resources to people who are vulnerable. But I'm not in favor of forcing people to be quarantined if they don't want to be quarantined for health, especially for healthy people. If they want to go take a risk of being with their family at Christmas, well, who am I to stop them? Right. I don't know what they value. And frankly, when I'm 80 and I have grandkids and there's some massive pandemic going around, I will, and it affects 80-year-olds, I will still have Christmas with my family. I don't care.
Yeah.
I'd rather have Christmas with my family when I'm 80 than live to 81 maybe and die before I get another Christmas.
Yeah.
I mean, but that should be up to me, not forced on me by somebody else.
I agree. And what proves your point is that those states that didn't have any of the anti-corona measures, no lockdown, no social distancing, no mask mandates, they didn't fare any worse than the other states that had harsh lockdowns, for example. I mean, one of the best examples is, of course, North and South Dakota, neighboring states. In South Dakota, they didn't do anything, and they didn't do any worse than North Dakota. We also took a look at the Amish people in Pennsylvania, who are totally disconnected from the modern world, so to speak, but who are still leading a very worthwhile lives, of course, but they don't have any electricity. They don't watch the mainstream news. So that took away some of the panic. And they said, let the virus take its course. And they didn't have any lockdowns, any social distancing, because they believe that in particular, when you're sick, you need a social life. You need to have people hug you, for example, or touch you. And what happened there is that in May of 2020, the whole thing was over. Without many people dying, it was just a regular flu season. That's how they explained it. Same thing is true for the Orthodox Jews in Israel. That's what two of the people who we interviewed here explained to us what was going on in Israel. So it doesn't, it shows that you're right when you're saying that was a catastrophic mistake what they made.
I mean, the example I like to use, in part because I've advised Governor DeSantis in Florida, but if you compare the age-adjusted COVID death rates from Florida versus the age-adjusted death rates in California, and you have to do age adjustment because the risk is so the risk rating is so great by age, it's almost identical through the pandemic. And yet Florida has had full in-person school for all its kids. It's had no closures of churches, no closures of businesses, only a limited, like I think some fraction of the counties impose masks. Mm-hmm. Whereas California has had very, you know, missed schooling, closed businesses, mask mandates, you name it. And now they're going to mandate, apparently San Francisco is considering mandating the vaccine for 5 to 11-year-old kids.
That's insanity.
So I think it's just impossible to escape what the data are showing, right? The data show that the lockdowns did not achieve its stated goal, which was to protect people from COVID. And in fact, what it did achieve was almost entirely negative: worse health, psychological and physical health, devastated economies, that for which we're going to be paying for a very long time.
Yes. The worst is yet to come from these measures. It's bizarre. And there were very early warnings, not just from your university, from you and John Ioannidis, of course, but also even from the UN. I forget the names of the people, but some of the very prominent people who work at the UN pointed this out very early on. I think in May of last year, they said the only thing that the lockdowns are going to do is they're going to make poor people even poorer, and they're going to make a lot of people starve, and that's precisely what happened.
Yeah, no, I saw those statements from the UN. I think it was definitely May of 2020. Yeah. Predicting catastrophic increases in poverty, and that is, you're right, that's exactly what happened. It's not like we didn't know. People were warned about, people were raising red flags about this, and yet we went ahead with it. I guess I was naive before. I thought that people, when they said they cared about the well-being of the people around the poor people around the world, they meant it. And yet, when fear came on us, we just forgot about it. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly immoral, right? We create a world, this globalized world, where these interconnections sustain huge numbers of people. I wouldn't say like well off, but at least not in poverty. Mm-hmm. And then overnight, we decide to take to change it because we want to protect ourselves. You know, pull up the drawbridge. So I guess the globalization was just a thin sheen on who we really are, yes. And the virus kind of exposed that.
Well. I think that the tide is turning. Just like Lee Dundas said, there's finally going to be a counter reaction. For parts of the population, this has been going on for a while now. But I keep telling people that if somebody had told me this a year and a half ago that we'd be wearing masks, that there'd be mask mandates, and we're talking about brand new vaccinations, which don't really seem to be vaccinations if you take a closer look, I would have told them to take their pills and go see a doctor. But in the meantime, of course, because of what we're doing here, talking to all these experts from all fields of science, in the meantime, I have come to the conclusion that this has never been about health from the beginning. It's never been about health. There were serious mistakes made, but I think that those who are, and I'm not going to get into the details of this because I know this is not your area of expertise, but we have come to the conclusion that those who are behind this, and you'll find out who it is if you just follow the money, that they didn't make any mistakes. This is done on purpose. The destruction of the economy is done on purpose. And I begin to wonder if the destruction of health is just a mistake, or there's more behind it, but we'll have to take a closer look into this.
I mean, let me put it in a way that's like consistent with how I think about this. Like, I think we have to do a real autopsy of what happened. In medicine, we have these like morbidity and mortality conferences after mistakes are made, after someone has died or something. Mm-hmm. We have to do that with this policy. What I'm afraid might happen is that the official investigations into and evaluations of this will be led by people who are themselves architects of the policy.
Yes.
We have to broaden the set of conflict of interest rules in those evaluations and include people who were dissidents in it, in that evaluation, in a serious way. Or else the public will not trust those evaluations.
Yes. Yeah,
you have wonderful guidelines in Stanford about institutional corruption. And I think it's a very good approach. We have institutional corruption not only in science.
Yeah, I think, I'm optimistic the pandemic will end sooner or later. I guess I don't know if I'm optimistic about our ability to evaluate it. And it's critically important that we do that evaluation properly, yes, or else this kind of thing that's happened these last 2 years will happen again, mm-hmm, with the same catastrophic harm to the population at large. And I don't think that we should let that happen. Science itself didn't work well during this pandemic, I think, because it was it shut down dissidents, shut down people from, it could cause people to, like, you know, why does it take bravery to speak up?
Yes.
In science, it should not take bravery to speak up in science.
It's a free country. We have, you and we have free speech, and all of a sudden that doesn't count anymore.
Yeah. So I think science failed, politics failed, mm-hmm, medicine failed, and we have to take that seriously. Like I can see a future where we take that seriously and say, okay, we don't want a biosecurity state, a state that's organized around the protection against a single infectious disease. I could also see a future where we head down that path. I mean, I'm looking at what's happening in Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah.
How do they get out of it?
Yes.
And, you know, we have something here that I don't know if that's decided already or if that's in the making, that they say, you know, the pandemic, it has ended. You know, they declare this in a law or in a declaration, the pandemic has ended, but they still want to continue the laws
with the against anti-corona measures.
Pandemic. That's very strange, you know. So it's really become a political perpetuum mobile of power continuation or expansion. So that has to end.
Yes.
You know, there has to be some serious, evidence-based approach on the whole thing.
2 years ago, this would be ridiculous. Yeah. But now there are only a few people that start laughing.
Yeah. Oh, well, Jay, Professor Bhattacharya, we're really, really grateful for you taking this time and explaining your view of what has been happening from a medical standpoint. I know it's pretty early still, but again, we thank you very, very much. And hopefully we can stay in touch, because I think there'll be more things to discuss pretty soon already.
Well, I it's a delight to talk with you. I've watched actually several of your videos and have learned that. Wolfgang, you as well. You all have been very brave, and I'm pleased to be able to talk with you.
We're great. You're part of the team, so to speak. We're grateful. Thank you very much, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.